Welcoming back to the program, a talented singer, songwriter, guitarist, producer. He's produced 3 Grammy-winning albums and has got a brand new album of his own that is absolutely terrific, intensely personal and powerful. It's called All the Eye Can See. We're happy to welcome back to the program, Joe Henry. Hey, Joe, thanks for coming back on with us. Good to talk with you again.
Nice to hear from you, Rich. I appreciate you reaching out.
So last time we talked with you, you had just recently arrived here in Maine. Are you officially settled in now as a Mainer?
I am. I mean, we moved into our house finally that we were building in Harpswell in late July of 2021. So we've just had our second Christmas in this house. And it still feels very new because we were in Los Angeles for so long, 31 years. But we are really enjoying it here. And I've traveled enough from here, I've come and gone enough to realize I can still just do exactly what I need to do from here. I can come and go with ease, and that's helping me feel not only grounded here, but still connected to my to the greater world, even though I live out in the woods by the water.
We were talking about you. Your name came up in a conversation on the show a couple of months ago with your friend Roseanne Cash, and she said, "Oh yeah, it's beautiful where Joe is. I've seen it, but she said it feels a little too remote for me."
It would be remote for Rose, no doubt, because she, she lives in a beautiful townhouse in Chelsea in New York City, and has been there for a long time. And I know that has really become home to her, and has been for a long time. I mean, there are times, I'll confess, when as new arrivals here, still, my wife and I can both feel a little isolated or far from our beloved community that we left in Los Angeles. But more often than not, we are really relishing, the peace of this place, and how much we are really enjoying. Like if I've been out, on a project or playing shows or something, to come back to just the incredible beauty and stillness that is Harpswell. And we've been so embraced by our, enclave of neighbors here on this private road where we live. And that's made all the difference to us starting to feel like we actually live here.
Well, the new album
is everything, as it turns out.
Absolutely. The new album is so good. I've been listening to it pretty much nonstop for about a week now. All the Eye Can See certainly was impacted in the recording process, at least, by the pandemic and all we went through. But how much of the content, the lyrical content of the album, came from that time as well?
Well, Rich, it's an interesting question, and I have differing feelings about what it means to dissect that. I certainly wouldn't suggest for a moment that the lyrical themes that surface and then resurface throughout this particular record, were informed by what we've all been living through. Having said that, I wouldn't suggest that this was in any way my pandemic album any more than I wanted anybody to think of the previous album as my cancer album. Mm. I certainly understand the relationship to what I've been experiencing personally and witnessing more broadly on behalf of all of us, as being, part of what is driving anything I'm doing creatively. But I always want to be cautious to, inform or remind myself, as I do any listener, that where a song comes from is not where a song is. Just because you understand, and I say this to myself again, just because I understand, the moment that allowed a song to happen, I don't think the song to be successful and to endure, we can continue to look at it as the song is, there's a song on this new album called Kitchen Door that I have said publicly, did grow out of the loss of my dear mother in May of 2020, but I don't think that that's all that song is, not for anybody listening, and not even for me. But I do recognize that it grew out of that experience and that tremendous loss. And I can't and won't pretend that that hasn't been a big driver.
Is it hard, Joe, when you release your songs into the wild to understand that they may be interpreted in a different way than you intended, or in a different feeling that than they meant to you during the process of creation?
Oh, no, that's not a problem for me. I assume that, and I count on that. You know, I work very consciously to create songs that I hope are vivid enough in their detail and seductive enough in their atmosphere that people would be attracted to, you know, to them. But I also want to leave enough doors and windows open in the house that each song is that would allow any listener to come and go through, you know, any open portal that they find and take what they might. And I know that songs can only be enduring and resonant for people if ultimately they can see themselves in there somewhere. You know, no one's going to carry a song of mine around in a very personal way just because this is what happened to Joe Henry. I have to disappear from the song once I've created it. I mean, truly, for it to endure as the statement that I mean for it to be, as the invitational vehicle that I mean for it to be. And I hope that's not too abstract to talk of it that way. You know, I do want them to feel connecting and solid and load-bearing in their architecture, but I relish when people have their own experiences with them and their own interpretations around them. That's everything.
As for the process itself, I understand that you kind of made it a mission to learn how to master Pro Tools and then reached out to some friends to see what and if they might like to contribute to your songs.
Well, mastery with Pro Tools is not something that I have achieved. I'm still, you know, working incredibly naively and get a lot of help, most notably from my son, Levon, who is a gifted reed player and a frequent collaborator, but also an excellent engineer, too, and he's taught me plenty. But, you know, like they say, a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. I learned just enough about Pro Tools early on in the pandemic to hear my voice and guitar return to me. And, you know, I've always sort of been that way. I'll grab something up, an instrument, and learn just enough to be in motion. And then I want to immediately start utilizing that to create songs, as opposed to the people who might spend months taking a class or reading manuals to understand actually, you know, mechanically what you're doing there. I seem to want to keep myself, for better and worse, you know, in that very instinctive space, which is great creatively, but sometimes can be very problematic technically. But, you know, suffice to say, Rich, I kind of got away with murder. You know, I learned to do just enough that it allowed me to open the door to so many of my friends and peers, and I'm so grateful for how generously they offered something to these songs.
Well, and they contribute so beautifully to the album. I love the work that Danielle Lenoir did, those two incredible instrumental pieces, one that opens the album and one that sets the stage for the album's closer, and they fit so perfectly.
That was an incredible gift, you know. I've known Daniel for a really long time. My wife was his manager for a dozen years, and, you know, I spent a lot of time in his proximity, learned a lot from observing and understanding something about the way that he works. But I'd never myself opened the door to the possibility of us collaborating musically. But as I was working on this batch of songs, that song that I first imagined would open the album, called Song That I Know, I sent it to Daniel and asked him if he might play pedal steel on it. I love his approach to that instrument. It's very unique, and I love the instrument itself. And a short while later, he reached back out to me and said, you know, I've been working on this, playing pedal steel, as you asked, but I don't think I really came up with anything that contributed significantly to what you're doing already. But what I did instead was I created two versions of an instrumental piece based on your melody. And if they're useful to you, you're welcome to them. He said, I really, really love them. And I heard them and immediately was attracted to how inviting I found them. And I immediately imagined that since he gave me two different versions of it, that rather than pick between them, that I would use them, you know, both as a as an overture and in that penultimate spot as a kind of resetting of the table for the closing song. And I think they add a lot of texture and atmosphere, especially as a point of entry.
And I think they add to what I would call a very cinematic feel to the album.
You know, hence me using the word overture, Rich. I think of every album as a movie. You know, I don't want to feel at the end of a project that it's merely a collection of songs. That just feels like a compilation, and they may or may not feel like they have connective tissue between them. But I really strive to make an album that feels like a movie at the end of it, where if you've bothered to listen from the beginning to end as it's presented, you'll feel like you've written, you know, the arc of a narrative, even if it's an abstract one. You know, I always want it to feel, you know, like a singular experience. So it pleases me greatly if you hear that as cinematic in some way, because that's always a goal. I always I'm reaching for that as an analogy, you know, as opposed to ever referencing other people's albums when I'm recording an album. I really avoid that. I don't think it offers much new perspective to anybody. But I reference film all the time because I love the correlation between an album as a complete statement and a movie as a complete statement.
We're talking with Joe Henry about his new album, All the Eye Can See. And I love, it was interesting to hear you talk about that because I love listening to your album and any album the way we used to listen to them, which is to go in the order that the artist intended. How much time and effort do you put into a selection of the order of the songs?
Oh, I think about that significantly, Rich. And I've been asked many times, you know, as an artist and a record producer, you know, how do I feel about living in the age of iTunes and iPods and whatnot, where people can shuffle everything? And, you know, my response is, you know, we've never been able to control, once we let go of something, how people choose to listen. You know, when I was, you know, a teenager and listening, you know, exclusively off of vinyl, I would put the needle wherever I wanted. I'd listen to the same song, you know, for days at a time. And, you know, I know that I can't be attached to how people engage with the work once it leaves my hands. But having said that, I believe that anybody who's willing to meet me where I'm asking to be met, you know, and listen to the whole thing in total, they should be rewarded with enough thought behind the construction of the whole album that there's an extra dimension to the experience if they go there. So in answer to your question, I spend a lot of time thinking about sequence. I understand that an album can be radically different just by reordering the song. And you know, there's a different point of entry. There's a different climax by inference. And it's important. Just like the album cover is important.
Absolutely. Well, after that wonderful overture by Daniel, a song that I know kicks things off, and it feels like just a wonderful window into the work and the soul of a writer.
Well, I appreciate hearing that. You know, I mean, that always is the goal, Rich, but, you know, you never know.
I have to ask about the song Karen Dalton. I understand you wrote it driving through Nebraska. And now it's certainly not a biographical story. How would you describe that song?
Well, it's one of those moments, and I've experienced it numerous times as a writer. You know, when I wrote in on my album Scar back in whatever year that was, 2000, I think, when I wrote the song, Richard Pryor addresses a tearful nation. Mm. I remember I was driving then, too, when that song began to unspool in my mind. And I was fairly deep into it before I understood that when I was singing in first person as I, that I believed it was actually Richard Pryor speaking. I don't know how I understood that, but I embraced it fully once I had the notion, and it informed atmospherically how I proceeded. And in the same case with the song Karen Dalton, I was driving, my wife and I were in on our road trip from Los Angeles to Maine, and I was driving late in an evening through Nebraska with my wife asleep in the passenger seat, and I started to hear this song, or these lines that open the song, take root in my mind. And somewhere very quickly, and I don't exactly know why, I believed that even though I was not telling her story, somehow I was building something that felt resonant with the way that I feel about her biography being, you know, she was incredibly gifted. Her life was intensely turbulent and troubled. And, you know, people seem to have no, you know, middling response to her. You know, either they're sort of brushed back by her or have never heard of her, or they're completely devoted to her incantations. But I felt her spirit somehow in there, and it felt right to honor her with the, you know, by titling the song after her. You know, I write a lot of things, Rich, that I can't really account for, and I, at the end of the day, I say I don't know what's going on, but I believe it completely. There's just a vibration that I feel, and I write something, and I instinctively know that this is what I mean, even if I can't translate in different words for somebody asking exactly what I, you know, what a song so-called means. To me, it just means that it is. You know, it's like stepping out into any weather system and say, what does it mean? It's like this experience doesn't mean anything other than that I'm having it. And that might sound elusive. I'm sorry if it does. I don't mean to be. But that's how I experience it.
The title track, All the Eye Can See, I understand that came to you during a walk.
In the early days of the pandemic lockdown, after my touring went away like everybody else's, and I found myself in this deep engagement of learning to record myself at home and got excited about it, songs just sort of came to me in a torrent. And I frequently, and there's probably five songs on the record, perhaps, that happened by my taking a solitary early morning walk and beginning to hear a song in my mind and starting to sing it to myself as I walked, and then just repeating it over until I got home and could write it down and find on a guitar what chords might support the melody I was just singing. And because I was learning to record myself, I just immediately recorded a version of it, you know, while it was that fresh and that immediate, as opposed to my old methods of sort of waiting till I had a full album's worth of songs, you know, fish in the boat before any thought about how I might articulate them as recordings. But these I just engaged as soon as they appeared, and then I sent them off to somebody for a contribution, and then I would start another song. So it was an unusual and exciting kind of revolving door of songs that appeared and me trying to record them, you know, with the same immediacy that I wrote them. And All the I Can See is, you know, an early example of that happening to me.
You mentioned your son, Levon Henry. He does wonderful work on the album. Nowhere more beautiful than what he does on the saxophone on Oh Beloved.
Oh, I think that's pivotal. You know, I was writing that song, and that song in particular has a, you know, had an unusual trajectory. I mean, as I hear it now as a finished song, I understand that what I was attempting to do is, you know, address the divine, however you name God, the universe, creation, you know, whatever your relationship, if you have one, to, you know, to the divine spirit might be. You know, I was trying to address that entity with the same, you know, familial and conspiratorial ease that some of the great mystic poets did. You know, Rumi and Hafiz and Rilke, I put in the same category. But having said that, the song itself grew out of what was initially a long prose poem that I wrote at the death of Little Richard. So, you know, of course, to me, going from something, you know, where I'm talking about Little Richard to becoming a song where I'm addressing God, that makes perfect sense to me.
Absolutely. Knowing what we know about Richard Penniman, yeah.
You know, we have to. You know, he was a mystical and transformative figure. But, you know, back to Levon's contribution on that, what that song became, I knew that small as it began with a single guitar in my hand that opens the song, I knew that that one needed to get kind of widescreen, and I wanted to make it fully orchestral. And for that to be successful, you know, I needed Levon's voice on the saxophone to sort of, you know, fly away with it. And I really needed it to lift off there and become more expansive than it might just from, you know, my lyric and melody alone. So I owe him a real debt there, because I think he achieved something that was, you know, not only significant but essential.
Boy, the song that I keep going back to, it hits me so hard, is one that you wrote for the film Downtown Owl. That's an adaptation, a friend of our show, Chuck Klosterman's novel. And Red Letter Day, it's so powerful and, you know, talks about that most essential issue that we all grapple with as human beings, I think. Yeah, how do we live in the moment when we're all fully aware of the fact that the clock is always ticking?
Well, I appreciate that a lot. I mean, it was a great opportunity to be able to, you know, to write for that film and to be driven, you know, by that invitation from T-Bone Burnett. You know, anytime I'm writing a song for a film, there's always that balancing act of wanting it to feel deeply connected to the story and its characters, but without, you know, being too on the nose by referencing things particular to the script or the characters by name. You know, you want it to run like a, you know, like a parallel emotional experience that will help illuminate what's happening on screen. And yet I always feel it still has to have its own integrity and stand alone and on its own outside of the context of the film for it to really do its job, because I understand that for it to really work in the film, people need to really hear the song and pay attention to the fact that it's there on purpose. But then they also need to be able to ignore it when the action on screen is asking for their attention. So it really requires that the song, you know, be really focused. But I also have to let go, you know, as in regard to my own ego. And it's not difficult, by the way, because I love film so much. But it really, I have to be really prepared, and not only prepared, but I have to find myself desiring that I'm making something transparent enough that when people need to see through it or hear through it to to what the film is doing, that it can both, you know, push forward as a song, but then sort of recede into the, you know, the role of score, which can be more subliminal.
We struggle, I think, as a people with maintaining a sense of community and connection, and social media certainly adds some challenges to that, as did what we've experienced in the last couple of years. What role does music, what role does art in general play in building community?
Oh, it's a wonderful question, and it's there's not a small answer to that, Rich, because I happen to think that the perhaps the entire function of all creative endeavor, I mean, art of every single discipline, is to connect us as human beings each to others, and to understand so much more completely than we're prone to day to day, that there's much more that connects us than divides us. You know, I think songs in particular, and, you know, it's interesting that I've heard both two friends of mine independently, T-Bone Burnett being one, and the great Billy Bragg of England, say to me at different points that music was, you know, was the original social media. You know, it's the way we started to learn from each other and carry each other's stories around. And those stories then helped us not to feel alone, because we could hear immediately that anything we were experiencing as mortal humans, no matter how dire, no matter how isolated and alone we might feel in those moments of personal terror, that we are in fact, that there are other people experiencing the same thing in real time, and that there's power in aligning ourselves with a greater community. And frankly, I don't think music has a greater purpose than that. I don't think art has a greater purpose than that.
Well,
I hope that makes some sense.
It does indeed, and I will tell you, Joe, this album certainly is a wonderful example of that. These are obviously intensely personal songs, and yet they touch that nerve. They speak to truths that all of us can relate to.
Well, you encourage me and affirm me by saying that, Rich, because it's something that I'm so aware of. It's my greatest desire, you know, as an artist. You know, of course, we all like to do, you know, well professionally when we're investing ourselves so deeply into something and, you know, with our time and energies. But beyond, you know, wanting to make a decent living and support my family, I've always been most primarily driven, you know, by a need for the music to connect, you know, not only my heart to yours, but hopefully your heart to your own mind, because I do think that when songs are operating as they can and do at their best, that's what's happening to us.
The album is called All the Eye Can See, the newest from Joe Henry. Joe, it's great to catch up with you again. Thank you so much for making some time for us today, and I hope you enjoy a beautiful spring not too many weeks away in Harpswell.
It seems like it's at our threshold, for sure, Rich. And I thank you for this time and all your generous thought around the new album. I really do appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you again, Joe.
Thank you, Rich.